Welcome. This is The Hustle, a podcast by Fundsize about creating great digital products. I'm Anthony Armendaris, and I'll be hosting today's episode. Our guest today is Peter Mirholtz, and we're going to have an exciting talk about why there's no such thing as user experience. Before we get into it, today's podcast is sponsored by The Iron Yard. The Iron Yard will teach you the tools and skills you need to become a professional interface designer or developer, and then help you find an awesome job. Check out theironyard.com to learn more. Actually, we're going to be heading over there to the Austin office today to see the portfolio reviews from their first class.
As soon as we're done,
So first and foremost, welcome back, Rick, from being gone for forever from paternity leave.
Yeah, I'm back. I had my wife had a baby, and he's awesome, and I'm happy to be back on the podcast.
Yeah, it's good to have you back.
Thanks, man.
A little introduction here for our guest. I'm very excited about today's episode. Peter is one of the most inspirational designers, at least from my career, a good friend of Fundsize, Peter Mirholtz.
Hi.
Hey, Peter. So for our listeners that don't know Peter, in 2001, he co-founded AdaptivePath, maybe one of the first agencies that really championed user experience. And they grew that company from a small shop to an international consultancy between San Francisco, Austin, and Amsterdam. After he left AdaptivePath, he was the VP Global Design at Groupon, where he actually hired Fundsize and was Fundsize's first client.
Thanks for that, by the way.
My pleasure.
if it wasn't for you, we may not have this podcast right now. So,
truth.
And currently, he's a senior director of design at Jawbone. But one of the most interesting things about Peter is he actually coined the word blog.
Is that true?
That is true.
Wow. That's awesome.
So, Peter, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit more about yourself and what you're doing.
Yeah. So, I mean, you pretty much hit the nail on the head with those various things. Most recently, I am the senior director of design here at Jawbone. For folks not familiar, Jawbone produces the Up Fitness Tracker as well as the Jambox. And joined just about 4 months ago, working now. I've never before worked directly in wearables and Internet of Things and health and fitness. And so I'm learning a lot and enjoying it. It's been a lot of fun.
Sounds really awesome. I saw yesterday some people in the office are passing around links to that new product that you guys just announced.
Yeah, we just released. It's been a long time coming, and we had already announced what we call the Up 3, but we also have now announced our Up 2 and our Up 4. So we have a family of products in market now. Price points for every wallet size and a range of kind of interesting features and capabilities. And what's interesting to me is knowing what I do know about what's coming here at Jawbone, what we've shared so far is scratching the surface of what we will be delivering over the next 6 to 12 months.
And that new one, the 4, it does like payments?
It does payments. NFC. Why not?
It's on your wrist.
You can put an NFC chip in a band and make it easier to buy stuff. Why wouldn't you?
That's pretty cool.
That's awesome. So, Peter, in December, you wrote an article that was titled "There's No Such Thing as User Experience Design." When I saw that, just the headline, I was a little bit shocked, you know, just because of your background. But I was also really excited because I've always had a sort of internal debate about what exactly is UX. You know, everyone is advertising themselves as a UX person or a UX UI person.
It is vague, yeah.
And I've always sort of believed that UX is the result of what teams create together, right? I always felt like it was, you know, it doesn't matter what you create, it's going to be a good or bad or mediocre user experience. Mm-hmm. And we read this article and we were really, really surprised. There's a couple of quotes that I'll read, and then I'm hoping that you can walk us through more of the details. So after the headline, you state that the entire field of user experience emerged for one reason: to accommodate and overcome poor or non-existent product management practices. Mm-hmm. And then you also went later in the article state that the job title and career path of UX design is broad and meaningless. Let's tell us more about this and let's kick this off.
Let me unpack that for you, and I'll I'm trying to think how far back to go. I could go back to 1998 when I emailed Don Norman and asked him about the coining of the phrase user experience, which he is credited with. It turns out there might have been some earlier ones, but I think when Don Norman was at Apple, he was the first to use it in a kind of professional context. He created, this was in the early 90s. I talked to him about it in 1998, but when he was at Apple in the early 90s, he created what was called the User Experience Architect's Office. And the reason he did that was he didn't want his team to be seen as focusing simply on user interface, but on the entire system that a user is engaging with. And that could include the out-of-the-box experience, manuals, software, hardware interfaces, all of that stuff. He recognized that it needed to be tackled together. But what when I reached out to him in 1998, 1999, already user experience had become kind of so vague as to be meaningless. And then in 2001, though, when we started Adaptive Path, we were very explicit. We called ourselves a user experience consultancy. And we were, I think, unique at the time in doing that. There were usability consultancies like Nielsen Norman Group and Creative Good, but no one who was talking about user experience. And Adaptive Path stuck with user experience for quite a while. At some point, 2008 or 9, we shifted from user experience to experience design. And that was, I think, as design was becoming a more a term that was elevating. When we launched Adaptive Path in 2001, 2002, we were actually very conscious about trying not to use the word design too much in describing what we did, because we saw that what most of our clients thought of as design was styling, was pixel pushing, was graphic design and very little else, and not the more kind of systems type of design that you get with interaction design and information architecture, and most definitely designers were not involved in issues of product strategy and really kind of defining what it is that you were building. Designers were expected simply to execute on decisions that other people had made. So we were very cautious around our use of the word design for quite a while. But around 2008, 2009, largely with the advancement of the design thinking movement that IDEO, probably more than any other entity, kind of led, design started getting a broader understanding and was seen not just as something that was about styling. Many people still do, but there was the conversation had shifted. And so my challenge, though, and a challenge I had for a long time, and I think you hit on it exactly, Anthony, is that I see, and I have some essay written in 2005 or 6 about this, I see user experience as an outcome, not as a practice, right? Something can have a good or bad user experience, and a lot of things go into whether or not a user experience is good or bad. The design of it is one piece of that. But the engineering of it is another piece. The customer service and customer care aspects is another piece. How marketing communicates the product and sets expectations is another piece. So there's a user experience is not simply the thing that that designers deliver. Designers influence it, but they influence it alongside a lot of other practices. And what I also saw more recently is that user experience design, someone who called themselves a user experience designer was usually what I would have called an interaction designer and an information architect.
Right.
Right. That I definitely agree with that.
Yeah. And we have terms in interaction designer and information architect, and they're perfectly good terms. And those better describe what you do than UX designer, because UX designer, while it mostly means interaction designer and information architect, it can also mean UI designer or visual designer. Like, people were cloaking themselves in this phrase, I think, because it sounded highfalutin and fancy. But right. I
probably the equivalent of today's product designer.
Well, yeah, product designer, I'm actually okay with, and we can touch on that in a moment. But I remember, I think it was shortly after I left Adaptive Path in 2010 or 11. I was talking with one of Adaptive Path's new employees, though, a woman named Toy Valentine, and she was wanting to reflect on kind of user experience from a new person's perspective, a kind of enlightened, intelligent, but younger professional's perspective. And the challenge she was having is, as a, you know, let's imagine you're a couple years out of college, you've maybe had a job, you're thinking about your second job, there's a job called UX designer. What is the path that you're putting yourself on? And I think this is something that the quote unquote UX design community has never been able to answer, which is, how do you grow as a UX designer? What is that path? What is that evolution? I can tell you how a visual designer grows, and an interaction designer grows, and an information architect grows, and a user researcher grows, and like all these other elements, I can tell you kind of what that evolution is. But UX designer is not really a career or profession that you can be on a journey with. And so, you know, the more I would kind of poke at this idea of UX design, the more it would kind of crumble under any scrutiny.
Right. And that's a good question. I don't want to jump ahead, but I mean, what is the next step for a UX designer? Is it not product?
And so where in the article that you're referencing from December, where I ended up was realizing there were at least, let's say, if we go back to Adaptive Path and the work we were doing there that we generally call user experience design, there were kind of two parts to it. There were the executional parts of UX design, the information architecture, interaction design, visual design. And then there were the strategic and more definition parts of UX practice that involves user research and coming, you know, using the user research to prioritize features and develop a roadmap and all those types of concerns. And something that I wasn't aware of when I was at Adaptive Path is that much of the strategic and planning aspects of user experience that we were doing was what inside a product organization was simply called product management. We didn't really have that view into how certain types of companies worked. You know, our clients were often really big corporations, very traditional companies that didn't have product management themselves, marketing departments who were told that they were in charge of the digital experience. Marketers don't have product managers. And right. so that phrase wasn't one that the term product management wasn't one that was used. But when we would work with these clients who didn't have product management, we ended up doing product management, not calling it that. We called it experience strategy because we saw it as the thing we needed to do before we did the experience design.
Right.
Once I left Adaptive Path and started working in-house, I realized that a lot of that experience, quote unquote, experience strategy work that we were doing, product managers considered their responsibility. There was a significant degree of overlap. And that's when I, you know, it was that kind of, as I've done that more and more at three or four different companies now, you know, that kind of led to, again, to this, me writing this article last December, where I'm like, you know what, UX, the thing that we call UX design, if you can kind of split it in two, those more strategic and planning aspects, that's product management. And that's great, and someone should be doing that. And the more executional aspects are typically interaction design and information architecture and visual design, and we have terms for that. And then what you're left is nothing. There's nothing there anymore when you've figured out where these things kind of better live. The phrase UX design kind of just evaporates. So.
I recall sort of identifying with that when I was reading it, because the way you sort of put into context the mentality that a designer will have, that they'll sort of always be thinking for the user, sort of resonated with me, and that the product side is always thinking more like in business terms. At least that, you know, maybe I extracted that, wasn't there in the article, but that's sort of what I was sort of like getting from it.
I think that's right. I think, and this is why I, you know, that quote that Anthony read around the, I forget what it was, but the historic lapse in product management practice, and why UX had to evolve in the first place. Product management has unfortunately been too business or technology focused. And maybe unfortunately is an overstatement, and it's simply just a product of time and evolution. But product managers who should have been thinking about users and customers in a deeply empathetic way simply weren't. They typically were either business folks, MBAs, looking at market sizing and a total addressable market and segmentation and how is what we're going to create, you know, serve a more abstract kind of understanding of a market. Or if you were, you know, there's a kind of Google strain of product management that are ex-engineers, and it's typically a form of engineering management. It's being able to coordinate technical efforts to lead to some outcome. And any product manager needs to be cognizant of the business and engineering challenges, but they should also be cognizant of the user or customer facing challenges, and they simply weren't, right? And so you kind of had this, you had designers who were bleeding for the user, getting briefs or requirements or whatever documents from product managers that had a lot of bullet points about business and a lot of, you know, understanding of what was feasible, but very little appreciation for what people would actually use. And so designers kind of had to create a set of practices, the user research and persona development and all these other more kind of strategic and definitional practices designers created in order to make sure that the product strategy acknowledged the users. And it was typically the people who were called user experience designers who were doing this. I think what we're starting to see that kind of I find quite affirming is more and more people who you had been thought of as user experience designers becoming product managers.
Yep.
Because companies are realizing that is as legitimate a perspective into leading a product as the business and engineering one is. Again, as long as that user experience bred product manager is also paying attention to issues of business and technology. So while I was at, I did a five month contract at OpenTable, the restaurant reservation company, and the thing I was brought in to do was to actually lead both product and design for the launch of their website redesign. And what, as it turned out, the design was basically done. So I was serving mostly as a product manager, and and doing a perfectly good job at it. And then while I was there, an old colleague of mine from Adaptive Paths, Alexa Andrzejewski, who had created a startup called Food Spotting, which had been acquired by OpenTable, she had been leading design, mobile design at OpenTable. While I was there, her boss said, you know what, you're now leading mobile product. You know, because her boss, the SVP of product at OpenTable is a woman named Jocelyn Mangan. What Jocelyn realized is like, yeah, there's no reason that a strategically minded designer couldn't lead product in the same way that a strategically minded engineer or business person could lead product. And in fact, for certain products, I think like mobile, where experience is so key to the success of that platform, it's not simply a matter of feature parity. It's a matter of the nuances of experience. You want product managers who really understand design and kind of have that empathetic mindset.
I definitely agree with that.
I mean, what you just described is basically the same sort of experience and battle with it I've had. You know, like when I worked at Behavior, people were hiring in the same time frame, you know, 2006, 2008 time frame, people were hiring us and giving us big budgets to do website redesigns. And this is before, like, you know, people were doing software on the scale that's happening right now. So, you know, the information architects, the interaction designers were, you know, definitely driving the strategic vision. Like, you know, the equivalent today is like backlog, you know, roadmap was like the feature value analysis and trying to get the scope locked down for this, you know, year long website that you're going to build. I think it makes a lot of sense too, especially in the way, in the things that are happening with product teams and mobile, for example, where you don't have as many people working on it. So the designers have sort of inherited a lot of the prototyping, interaction design, visual design aspects. And the product world had, and it makes sense now, like why the product world has kind of resisted some of the more traditional, you know, IA and research oriented stuff, because their product managers doing it. And I think anyone that has worked with a product company and really closely with good product manager, like, understands that this person that you're working with is very, very broad and skilled. And, you know, he's talking to the customer, hopefully, and planning the features, and knows what's going to be successful, and can plan a good roadmap, and can critique design, and critique features, and the polish on the final product and everything. And
yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. An analogy I used, I gave a talk at Adaptive Paths UX Week in 2012, where that was my last attempt at defining UX design as a profession. Like, if there is such a thing as a UX designer, this is what that person is. And where it ended up is as a role that other people were calling product manager, because the idea was, if UX designer is a profession, it's a coordinating role across a bunch of other design disciplines. You know, an interaction designer, a visual designer, information architect. You know, who has the vision? Who is the leading all that work? I could see a UX designer leading it in much the same way. The analogy I drew was in much the same way that a film director, you know, coordinates the efforts of actors and cinematographers and editors and sound designers, etc., into a single kind of a singular vision. And the other realization, whether you call it a UX designer or a product manager, as an analogy to this film director role, a film director can come from any number of different backgrounds, right? Some come from a more of a camera-oriented cinematography background. Some are former actors. Some are writers. Some are editors, right? But they have evolved such that not only do they know the craft that they learned, they have that bigger picture view of understanding how to coordinate multiple crafts people toward a common goal. And yeah. I see that as what a successful product manager should be able to do, you know, kind of in the way that you just described, Anthony.
Yeah. So, I mean, I hate to, you know, just bring this in out of left field, but kind of related to this is I heard a podcast you were on Discovery Session when you were talking about your ideas around organizing teams to achieve like ideal outcomes.
Right.
And, you know, I think a lot of people that listen to our show are engineers, product designers that are at product companies, and designers who are or freelancers or agencies. So I was hoping we could talk a little bit about, you know, just this structure, how these people work together, and then, you know, and then maybe focus a little more on how the agency can work with the product team, knowing that the product manager on the client side is actually owning the strategy, no longer a senior level person on the design side that's really owning that process, and how these teams can work together to, you know, create the best possible things.
Sure. I have a lot of thoughts around team makeup, kind of at a couple levels. There's the within a design organization, kind of what makes sense for a good design team, and then within a more kind of cross-functional world of my experience here, a job owner, a Groupon, where, you know, we have designers and engineers and product managers and possibly other people, writers and data scientists and all, and how do you get that group of folks working together as effectively as possible? And I think the first thing to say is it is not solved and it is hard. And anyone who tells you they figured it out is lying. They might not, they might be lying to themselves. They might think they figured it out, but it is still quite. I'm finding it quite challenging, like identifying some optimal organization that would work everywhere. So, just to kind of preface whatever we say with that, so that I'm not coming across, because I'll probably say things that sound definitive, and I want to make it clear that I'm still figuring this out as much as anyone else.
Oh, we're on the same page there. I mean, even our team, you know, there's nine of us, but we're all broad, but we all have like area of focus. So
we're definitely iterating our.
Well, and business. I'm curious. Yeah. I'm kind of curious. You know, I left consulting in part because I found. The relationships we were having with our clients were not, we weren't having the level of impact that I wanted to have in terms of that final product. And I'm curious, you know, how you guys structure your engagements. Obviously, I worked with you early in your, earlier in your organizational development. And maybe it continues to work that way, or maybe it's changed. But how are you structuring your engagements such that you're not feeling like a design factory that's getting in a brief and spitting out a design,
right?
And also such that you feel like you are, if you want to challenge the client on assumptions that they're making. How are you able to do that in a way such that that challenge, if you have a good point and it's something to be considered, you feel like that challenge is being kind of recognized within the client organization? Because, you know, the bane of a design firm is handing over a design, and then when that design gets finally delivered, it doesn't look anything like what you did. Or you work with them, say, on that launch, right? And so the design looks exactly like what you did. But then when you come back 6 months later after you've left and they've iterated to something that now doesn't look like anything like you did. And so what have you figured out, or what are you in the process of figuring out when it comes to how an external design capability can best relate to an internal product team?
We kind of turned that one around.
Well, I mean, I have a lot of thoughts on this. And if you ever want to talk one-on-one, I'd love to have a more in-depth conversation with you. But even though what we have right now isn't perfect, it works really well. I mean, from the engagement side, we just kind of simply put together a team, a three-person team. It's a project manager / agile coach and two product designers that work at a consistent pace every sprint and every month. So while we're working on these engagements, we may be working on multiple products. So we bring our ideas to the table, our clients bring their ideas to the table and their priorities to the table, and we very simply just plan work in the order that makes the best sense. We're allowed to put ideas into the quote-unquote ice box and try to drive the roadmap. We're involved in, you know, at least quarterly meetings to sort of hear a recap of where the product company is going and the recent research and what we can do to help steer it in the right directions. But you're right. I mean, a lot of the work that we're doing is 2-week sprint based work. So the designers are usually only able to see, you know, 2 to 3 sprints out. But we believe that we actually want to add value to the long term. So we're not always able to. So the way that we were able to find a solution to that was by simply doing that kind of work for free. When we want to.
On the side.
Right. So like right now, the way it works is we work Monday through Thursday with our clients on the roadmap work. And then we have a program called Special Ops. And Special Ops teams can design anything for a client that they're working with, but there's only one rule. It has to be something that is not in the roadmap. So we'll use that as a way to, you know, to try to steer the product or change the product. And there's really two kinds of engagements we have. A Groupon scenario where we're brought in on an existing product where one or more product managers or executives or team members are owning the strategy, and other products which are the sort of zero to first release kind of projects where we get to drive more of the strategy of and the qualities in the actual first release. So I find, at least for my interest in running the studio, it's good to have a mix of those. That way, you know, all the designers get to flex their muscles, and have different requirements every time.
Yeah, and as being one of those designers that's sort of on that whole thing, we work, you know, we do client work from Monday through Thursday. So those Fridays allow us to sort of, you know, drift away from like being like on this hard schedule that we're on all the time. And, you know, we sort of have like visions for products that we work on too. And it's sort of a chance to... it's sort of a chance to like, okay, well, this is how we think it could be better. And we sort of like break down a lot of red tape and, you know, just let them like see our vision. And it doesn't always like get built, but you know what? It has a couple times with a couple of our couple of clients that we liked. It's actually even like, as I recall, I don't know if it's okay, so I won't say the name of the client, but it even changed like the the plan, like the direction that one of the products we were working on in.
Yeah.
So do you know, guys, when you have these kind of dual designer teams plus project manager, for one thing, that sounds a little bit like what Cooper does, and I don't know if you've compared notes with anyone over there. They're big proponents of they actually do formalized paired designing. I don't know if that's how you're approaching it, but is that designer pair dedicated to a client and a project, kind of the whatever it is, 40 hours a week or 32 hours a week if it's Monday through Thursday? Or
the struggle that we have is that about half of our clients are enterprise clients with good budget that can afford like two or three full-time people at a time. But the other half are the early stage startups or the Series A, B companies that really can't afford the cost of two full-time designers. But we strongly believe in teams working together, having more than one head, because what happens is if we were to staff one designer, even if that designer is fully competent in, you know, in interaction design and visual design and prototyping, if they're working on that one project by themselves for 3 to 6 or 9 months, they're going to leave our company, just like just like they would leave a startup if they were like the only designer.
You're not even really an employee of that agency anymore. You're like an employee of that product.
So what we typically do is we'll have the two designers working on that, but they're sharing a velocity, meaning that every designer at Fundsize has one project in which they are accountable for, and one where they are supporting another design lead. But all the designers on our team are broadly versed in interaction design, information architecture, user testing, visual design, et cetera, et cetera. But every person has their own strengths and weaknesses. So we try to pair the teams up with complementary skill sets, and even our project managers design now. Mm-hmm. So or help with, you know, gathering user feedback or prototyping. But yeah, I mean, it's our challenges are a little bit different because we're not a product company that has a lot of cash flow. We're trying to accommodate the cash flow needs of a product company.
Got it. Interesting. Yeah. Well, and one thing you mentioned that I think is worth highlighting, which is that no designer work alone. I think one of the problems that I've seen since coming in house. And I saw it at Groupon when I joined, and it's not uncommon in the Valley, is this idea that you can only hire, you know, quote unquote unicorn / full stack product designers, because you need to be able to have an individual who works with, you know, four engineers and a product manager to execute on some part of the product experience. And I find that a recipe partly for crazy making, because that designer's only really dealing with, you know, they're not dealing with other designers much day to day.
It's not really fair almost.
I think that's right. I think that's right. And the other thing I saw was that too often designers would do maybe perfectly fine work in the isolation of their product team, but when you brought together the efforts of all these kind of soloed and siloed designers into a whole, those different decisions that they were making in different parts of the product experience didn't come together well. And so I, one of the first things I did, well, not one of the first, it took a while. So it, at Groupon, it took me about 9 months, but because when I joined, I inherited this pile of maverick cowboy product designers who tended to operate like this. I brought on a kind of design manager, design director, for lack of a better word, layer, five or six of these folks around whom I could form design teams that these people would now be part of, so that you never, as a designer, you were never working alone. Because right. I think that's exactly right. You don't want designers to work alone. At least having one other person is more than twice as good.
That's very true. Two designers are going to do more and better work than, you know, one designer, but more than just 200% of what one designer.
I think that's right. And then what you mentioned, the kind of unfairness, one of the things that was important also about bringing this kind of design leadership layer. So you can imagine me, when I joined Groupon, I was a VP, and there were 30 people on my team, including, you know, 12 to 15 product designers who had no structure, no management. Like, they were all reporting up to me at that point. And a lot of these, most of these folks were in their early 20s. This was their first or second job. And so it was easy for a product manager or an engineer to kind of push them around, because they just didn't know any better. They didn't have experience, expertise, gravitas, whatever it is that allowed the designer to have real influence and authority. They were simply kind of taking what they were given and executing against that. And by bringing on this design leadership layer that kind of sat between me and the team, those design leaders could have way more productive conversations with product management leadership and engineering leadership to make sure that design perspectives were being appropriately considered. That ended up being a huge kind of evolution for the design team within Groupon.
That's really smart, because I think you know, what you just described happens all the time in almost every, you know, tech company or product company we work with. And individuals are so, these days, especially the young guys and girls, are used to working quickly and iteratively, but they don't necessarily know when or how to solve some of the bigger challenges that actually steer the product in the right direction. I've seen it before where, you know, a young designer would spend weeks or months iterating like one screen over and over again and could never get buy-in on it. And no one, and everyone knew that it was wrong, but no one knew to say what was wrong about it. It's because they didn't like do enough research or look at different lenses of where the direction could go before they made a decision. And, you know, money and time being spent and all that is really challenging. And when you are, you know, one person or even sometimes two people in a, large engineering team, it's really difficult. We recently had the two product designers from Photoshop on our podcast, and it was really crazy to learn that there was two designers to 60 engineers.
Yeah. Talk about not fair.
but maybe you could help, because of these things that you were dealing with. I mean, is that why you brought Funsize into the fold to try to complement the team and have other more brains, or was it more about like the workload, or, you know, for
we just didn't have enough people. One of the things that I was asked when I joined Groupon that was asked of me was to make it so that design was not a blocker. And that was because the design team wasn't big enough for all of the things that were needed design. And, you know, there's two ways to solve that problem. Hire a bunch of designers, and if you can't hire fast enough, work with external firms. And so, I mean, if memory is not failing me, it was that reason that we brought you guys in. I mean, we had been talking to you since before you had started Funsize, as you were figuring out what was next. Yeah. Really liked your work, and you know, when you started Funsize, the other thing is we had a a fairly well-bounded product problem that we could bring someone from the outside into. And that's a challenge, I think, for especially kind of nouveau, new model tech companies with product disciplines to figure out is how to appropriately engage external design. You can either kind of do it like we did, where we're like, here is a product that you guys can just design and be the design team for it and work with the product manager and the engineers. And we will have a design director kind of keeping tabs just to make sure that it's okay, but that we can kind of just give off. The other model is when you can't quite peel it off like that, and it's much harder, is basically designers having to embed within an organization's product team and just be like possibly working with other in-house designers, et cetera, if it's kind of a staff augmentation challenge.
Yeah.
I don't like doing that. I'd rather hire a contractor than an agency for that kind of thing. But you guys were, clearly talented product designers, and we had a product that needed design, and it was conceptually a pretty easy decision to make. So that was what that was about. And this might frustrate you as what I'm about to say, but I tend to be of the mindset like trying to bring all the design that you need in-house. And yeah. I have not yet gotten to a point where I've been able to hire enough designers and feel like I have all the design in-house to then realize, okay, there are opportunities for external perspective to change how we're thinking, right? Because that's one of the reasons that, stated reasons that a lot of companies hire agencies is they want a fresh perspective. They want someone who's not steeped in this day in and day out to kind of bring that mindset.
I think another fun thing about the agency world right now is there's a lot of opportunities to help companies bridge the gap from one designer to, say, four. Actually help them interview and hire designers, train them on the processes and stuff like that, build design culture, or heck, like even just have a Slack channel where people can talk to a design thinker or leader, like without being alone, being that one, like alone designer.
Yeah.
And that's where my head's at. Like to me, I feel like it's just as important to help the people you work with find the right people as it is to help them do.
It's almost like a design mentorship kind of thing for your client.
Right? Yeah. And I think, and I've been hearing more and more that that's happening as more companies are trying to bring design in-house. I mean, this is in the history of this type of kind of technical business still relatively recent. It's only in the last, I would say, 10 years that there's been this kind of understanding of having internal design teams is as the norm for these types of companies. And now as we have more and more companies and all these startups and all this activity, the number of people trying to do design internally is just like gone through the roof. And it's largely being planned by people who know nothing about design, right? You've got your CEOs and your business people and your engineers, and they don't know anything about design. They just know that they need design internally, and they have no idea how to do that. And so I know Cooper's coming up again just because I had drinks with a friend from Cooper recently, and it was something he mentioned is that many, if not most, of their engagements now are as much about helping these clients understand how to build the design competency internally as it is about doing design work. And at Adaptive Path, we had a little bit of that, but by the time I left, at least, that corner hadn't quite been turned. And I think that corner has now been not only turned, we're all driving down that freeway right now. Right. And it's hard because design teams within an organization are different than other types of teams. What I've seen is that, people tend to take the template of either a marketing design team, which a lot of companies actually had, and try to apply that to kind of a product design team. And I don't think that's quite right. Or they take the template of an engineering team and try to apply that to a design team. And that's also not quite right. There's, you know, these disciplines are different. The people who practice them are different. The way that people who do this work, the ways that they feel successful are different. And you need to make sure that you're not just, you know, having your designers operate as if they were just another flavor of engineer. That's only going to end up frustrating your designers after a while.
Wow.
Definitely. I can definitely say that I've been in that very seat. Just feeling like I'm a different flavor of engineer rather than a designer.
That's a good, maybe another good podcast.
Yeah. Another good episode. We're actually over time. Just need to point that out. Yeah. So we're going to probably have to wrap up here.
Well, Peter, it looks like we can all hang out at Front Conference in Salt Lake City.
Oh yeah. Oh, I forgot.
Yeah. I think we're taking the whole company. Yeah. So, maybe I can pick your brain over a beer or something.
If I hear you can find beer in Salt Lake City, but it's a little more difficult to.
Okay, we'll bring some beer.
We'll ship it.
So I'm looking forward to Front. I think it'll be fun. Salt Lake City is beautiful. It'll probably be hot in June, but I look forward to hanging out with you guys.
So for those of you who haven't heard of Front, it's the first conference that I've seen in a while that seems to be dedicated to the practices of product design and product management. Yeah. So. Yeah. We're definitely going.
We're excited. You should
check it out. Peter, thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedule to chat with us. This has been really awesome. How can our listeners connect with you online?
Well, first, let me thank you for the opportunity. I always enjoy having these conversations, and I learned something when I was able to turn the tables and ask you some questions or how you guys are structured.
That's awesome.
So I always look for opportunities to learn myself. You know, the easiest way to find me, Twitter at PeterMe, my website, PeterMe.com, which sadly I haven't written on much since last December when I wrote that blog post. Those are probably the two primary ways to find me. Email me at PeterMe@PeterMe.com. If you want to reach out directly, always happy to talk about these topics.
Dang, he just threw his email address out there. Yeah, so I'm just at Rick Messer, if you want to follow me too.
And I'm Mantwan, M-A-N-T-W-A-N, and you can find more about the podcast on funsize.co/hustle or follow Funsize on Twitter. Please take a moment to rate our podcast or subscribe on iTunes if you can, and send us any topic suggestions.
Just tweet to us at Funsize if you have like something you want to, you know, discuss.
Well, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
Today's podcast is sponsored by The Iron Yard. The Iron Yard will teach you the tools and skills you need to become a professional interface designer or developer, and then help you find an awesome job. Check out theironyard.com to learn more.
Hustle is brought to you by Funsize, a digital product design agency in Austin, Texas, that creates delightful, innovative products for mobile, web, and beyond. Visit us on Twitter @Funsize or visit our website at funsize.co.